everyone, and welcome back to Bookish. I'm so thrilled to be back, and sorry to have made you all wait so long, but here we are. Better late than never. My first guest for season two is my great friend, Kate Walsh. You all know Kate as Addison Montgomery from Grey's Anatomy and then her show Private Practice. You may also know her as Olivia Baker on 13 Reasons Why, currently on Netflix. Kate is a magnificent actress and also the founder of Boyfriend Perfume. And Kate was lovely enough to have me in her home. She was renting a place in Malibu at the time, which was very convenient for me. And we recorded this very shortly after Kate had had major shoulder surgery. And it was so lovely to have her and so fun to sit and talk together about books in a way that she and I occasionally do, but not in depth like this. So I hope you enjoy listening to it as much as I loved recording it. Here's Kate Walsh. Hi, lovely Kate Walsh.
Hi.
Thank you so much for doing this.
I'm so excited.
It's so fun to have you. What are you reading at the moment?
Well, I feel embarrassed about saying, so let's just start it with that.
Okay,
I feel highly unqualified and totally embarrassed, but someone just gave me the book Women Who Run with the Wolves.
Uh-huh.
Have you heard of this?
Yes, I have.
It sounds like a book that I would, when someone told me, this person told me about it, I rolled my eyes internally thinking, oh, this sounds like, it's the worst name ever. It sounds very self-helpy from the 80s, but it's actually not. It's sort of the Iron John, I think, for women. It's all mythology
and I think I've read it.
It feels very Kim.
Yeah, I was about to say, I think Kim may have talked about it.
It's very, like all sorts of mythology and sort of soul work and Jungian based, and she's a Jungian sort of therapist. And so but because I was knowing I was going to be doing this podcast, I've been sort of rereading everything. And dipping back into old books. And
we should say that you're not even in your house at the moment. You're in a rented house.
I am in a rented house.
All your stuff is in storage.
That's correct.
Which, having just done this podcast myself, I have just been sitting through my own interview with my friend Joe. I realize how badly I relied on my bookcases when Joe was asking me, you know, to send him my 5 books. And to be able to dash around them. And even though the 5 that I ended up with, not all of them were on the bookcases, I used them as prompts in such a big way to be like, oh yeah, what else was I loving in that moment? And as I was driving here, I was thinking, oh, you didn't have access to that. Did you just go online? Did you just sit and think?
Well, I have one stack of books that I brought with me that's in my bedroom, but mostly books that I haven't read, a couple that I love, but mostly I thought, you know, since I'm going to be here at the beach, it would be a great opportunity to just read and catch up and try to get to all these books that I haven't read. But it was a great opportunity, actually, the process, which was daunting and terrifying. I felt like I was preparing for, you know, a massive exam.
So
even
bad.
Though you said don't feel that way, I still did because I was afraid of sounding like an idiot. But the biggest gift was just a theme of recollection and going back and, like, the gift of going back into my childhood and thinking about. And so the biggest surprise was the first book, Cannery Row.
Mm. Which is, I just always make sure that we tell people what it is. So
yeah.
Cannery Row, John Steinbeck, published 1945. What made that? Why did that make the cut?
This was so crazy because, again, I was thinking, and it happens to be that I'm in Malibu. I'm in this dreamy kind of, you know, place that I've always sort of fantasized about, being on the sand and tide pools. And so I had been thinking about, like, the origin of me reading. And, you know, as a child, of course, like, you know, Dr. Seuss and all these things and The Velveteen Rabbit and Phantom Tollbooth and all the. But my stepfather, it was this great recollection of the relationship that I started with my stepfather, who came into my life when I was 7. And he was really hugely responsible for giving me books.
Really?
And encouraging that part of myself. And we moved around quite a bit. But one thing that I had done with my family, both before my parents were divorced and subsequently with my stepfather and my mother, was we camped up and down the coast of California a lot. That's what we did when we took our holidays and stuff. And there were all these beach towns in Monterey and Pismo Beach and Carmel and Big Sur. And so he thought it would be interesting to give me a book at, I'm not kidding, like 9.
Right.
By John Steinbeck, mm-hmm. because it was written about all the places that I had explored. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at that age, I didn't think anything that I'm reading. That's probably the only 9-year-old reading John Steinbeck.
Probably.
But it was a funny thing because when I would go to, and it wasn't like in any kind of arrogant way, but I would want to share with other kids, like, are you reading Steinbeck? No? Pity. But
more's the shame.
but for me, it was this magic as a child of like, wait a minute, someone's writing about what I know.
Right.
That was mind-blowing to me. I'm reading about Monterey, about the canneries, which of course, you know, in the late 70s when I was reading this book had already been shut down and turned into sort of museums or whatever, but the tide pools and all of these beaches in the sort of that area of California. And also it was twofold. So one, to have the experience of someone writing about what I had experienced as a child was, I was like, I didn't even know that was possible.
Wow, yeah.
So that was really cool. But secondly, I had already experienced so much in the way of sort of divorce and the dissolution of my family. And my father, had been an alcoholic, and there was all this shame and a lot of drama around mm-hmm. the divorce and everything that happened between my parents and my family, also in California. So that, to have someone write about characters that were, you know, drinking a jug of wine a night, or mm-hmm. these crazy characters that were all sort of lovable in such a loving way that Steinbeck did, with, you know, these brothel owners and people that were in and out of jail and sort of with such humanity and love, mm-hmm. was like, it made me feel less alone and yeah. like completely, I feel like an outsider already, and yet there's this band of misfits that he's writing about that I love. And he wrote in such this kind of folk way of story. I don't know how to describe it, but that I just felt like it was very easy to read mm-hmm. for me, and I immediately was just lost and in love with this world. And then I remember later years they made a movie, and I remember going, they took, you know, Sweet Thursday and Cannery Row and made it into the, I was, you know, it was the first time right. I had that experience uh-huh. of, well, that's not really my movie.
It's not my movie. You know? Sure.
So, but that was, I had forgotten all about that.
And did you feel, when you'd read it, were you able to, did it make you feel less of a misfit to be able to share it? Like, did your brothers and sisters read it?
No one else was reading it. I just felt like it was probably the beginning of me escaping into that fantasy world. Right. But I felt seen and shared and understood and heard because of Steinbeck and all these people. I was like, oh, this is great, you know? And it sort of, I credit it with really, I just like any book starts, you know, sets fire to your imagination, but makes you feel less alone, or you're like, I love this world.
Yeah.
And again, it was that big component or element of there's no shame for any of these people.
Yeah. It's so interesting because it's one of the Steinbecks I haven't read. And so it was fun reading about it and just looking up and seeing what it was about. And the essence of the plot was so simple from what I read. It's that Mac and his friends are trying to do something nice for their friend Doc, so they decide to throw him a party.
Yeah.
And then it all goes horribly wrong, and the party rages out of control. And then Doc's lab and home are ruined. And then to return to his graces, they decide to throw him another party, and this one goes better. And I just was so struck by how, what a simple premise that is, and then how you draw a whole community in with that very simple idea. And there's something about best intentions going awry that I can imagine. I mean, I was interested that it was your first book. I didn't imagine you were only 9 when you read it. But that would feel so relatable as a child, that as a child we so often have good intentions that go awry.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
More so often as an adult. But as a kid particularly, you know, the careful attempt at making your mum breakfast in bed, but meanwhile the kitchen is trashed. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, well, in the madness, because I, you know, to be sure, my house was a jungle. It was crazy. Our family was really, it was pretty nuts before my parents got divorced. So to have an experience of kind of madness that was all entertaining and lovable and somehow you know, good intentions, even if it went bad, it was okay. Mm-hmm. And we'll just try again and do all another right. party. But I do remember feeling like I wanted to share it with other people and there was no one else, you know, my age to share it with. Yeah. You know, I did talk to my stepdad about it, you right. know, but no one else. Like,
I relate to that too. I think of reading as something that was both, and to this day, really, I mean, I have girlfriends I'll share, you being one of them, that I'll share a book recommendation with. But reading is at once this sort of lonely experience and deeply soulful experience of finding community, because it's mm-hmm. it's so private. It's not the shared experience of going to a movie or sitting at home watching a TV screen or even listening to the same piece of music together.
Yeah.
My experience of Cannery Row at 42 is going to be different to yours at 9, is going to be different to mine if had I read it at 9. You know, they're just, it's both so private and can either confirm your solitude or, as it sounds like, also make you feel like you're seen and that there's a world that you belong in.
Yeah.
I see that. Well, your next book that you gave me was Howard's End.
Yeah.
Is that the next one? Is that chronologically the next one you'd want to talk about?
Yes. That, and I feel like there is kind of a theme here too, because this is also, you know, we have others too, but our generation particularly has the kind of experience of growing up in the age of film and television and that being a, you know, arguably the kind of main format of storytelling or the most popular mm-hmm. in the late 20th and early 21st century. So as such, I kind of felt like, oh, I can't talk about these without talking about films as well.
Sure.
Right? I mean,
sure.
I didn't even think about how or about Cannery Row, the movie, but I remember being very excited as a kid. I was like, I read that book. I can't wait. And then always being so disappointed.
Yeah.
But it was Howard's End was, I picked that one because that, again, I was a freshman in college, I think, and I was taking a course in modern British literature.
Where were you at college?
At University of Arizona, which was actually the number one party school in the nation, but I didn't know about that. I just was I was in Tucson, and that was my state school, and I was like, I'm going to go here, and I probably had no business going because I changed majors like 800 times, and...
What did you start out with?
Well, I thought started out with my mom's like, get a degree in computers because that, you know, only my brother Joe had gone to college before. Yeah, get it, computers. Idea. Right.
So good.
So I started out in business and then I quickly switched to like poli sci. I don't know, that sounded vague uh-huh. enough. And then I was like, what am I doing? And then I thought, I landed on general studies, which was an option, which was 3. You could do, so I picked English, modern British lit. Art history and Italian.
Perfect.
Yeah, it was great until I eventually dropped out and just went and did acting, you know, and it's like, but because my brother went there before me, the best thing was he got me into these English classes that were 300 and 400 level where you could just read and talk about books and write essays on them and stuff. So I had a couple of great professors and Roger Bowen was this one and his was modern British lit. And so Ian Forster, Howard's End,
1910, that came out, yeah.
And that, I had just broken up with my first big love of my life. I had this very sort of young relationship from 15 to 19.
Wow.
And his mother was a huge part of that relationship. She was Mrs. Salins. She was like Mary Poppins. And I didn't have that kind of a mother growing up. And she was so attentive. And she was the most... So. Ending that relationship was also ending the relationship with her, which was huge, like a big trauma for me, losing that.
Did you end it because of going to university or were you already there?
I was already there. And so we had broken up sometime in the beginning, like, you know, and this was shortly thereafter. So it was probably like my second year at school that I was reading this. And the mother, Mrs. Wilcox, in that book, I just was obsessed. I felt like the whole thing and her and the home. And also I had this thing because I had moved so many times, like literally, I think I moved 15 or 17 times before college. I had this sort of mythic idea of home and this very, like, I still, you know, and now I end up moving as an adult all the time, but I really for a long time was obsessed and with what I couldn't have, which was like a family home or someone, the idea of a country home or this place where, and this family, the Wilcoxes, and just they were sort of insane and beautiful and wonderful. And she was this mother that roamed the garden, and it was like the embodiment of home and mother. And I loved it. I just, it was my favorite book. And the line, you know, only to connect. This is just the, that was just it for me. And none of the other, that for me, that was my favorite book of E.M. Forster's. And for that reason. And I, and then I remember when that film came out, and I was just like, I was infuriated. I was like, this is not my movie. And I finally at that time understood, like, oh no, don't go see it. Don't go see the films because
of the book you love.
Of the book you love, because, you know, for lack of a better explanation there, I make, you know, so you have your own film, you have your own movie, you have your own, I mean, you know, it's just funny the power of creating these characters, whether they're described to you or not, but just having a real visceral, soulful experience of who these people are.
I totally agree. I think also they say, you know, that it's a second degree novel that makes a great movie, that a great novel by definition cannot make a great movie, because a great novel is interior. A great novel is about these tiny schisms and moments and interiority, I think, anyway, that you can't put on
the
screen. There's no way in, no matter how accomplished the actress. You don't know that she's thinking about her, you know, third birthday as she walks down the aisle towards the man she doesn't want to marry, or the, do you know what I mean?
Like, there's no way. That's right.
That. So you can't, so you forfeit so much from the movie.
I know, and it's almost like my own greed, our own greed wants to try to make the movie. You know,
you're
like, I don't want it to end. I don't want the story to end. I want to bring it to a different kind of life. As opposed to, well, the best you really can do is go back and reread it and see what, and then even then it's going to be a different experience, you know?
Yeah. Have you reread it since then?
I just started a little bit since I knew I was going to do this, but no, I haven't.
It was fun, again, when I was reading about your books, and I thought, oh, Howard's End, I know that. Let me just quickly look it up. And I look it up, and I'm like, oh, fuck, no, I never read this.
It's
I
so saw the good, movie. Right? Oh, you saw the movie.
I saw the movie, and I realized as I was reading it, and I sort of then went in, and somewhere on the internet, you can actually leaf through the book kind of thing. So I was leafing through it, and I was like, no, I don't know these people. I thought I did, but no, I actually don't know them. I know the what's the name of the people that made the movie? The
Merchant Ivory.
Yeah. I know them in this. I don't know these individuals of it. So this has now gone on the list of things that I want to
It's great. I love, because just even in perusing it again, I was like, oh, you go right in with the letters. There's just an intimacy and a quickness to, you're dropped. He has this magical way of just dropping you right into the world immediately. And with these, and there's, I feel like I'm a guest in their house, and I'm or like I'm watching, and I felt so included. And so there's all these like sort of psychological, emotional things that really worked on me. Again, it brings me back to this family that my first boyfriend, the Salins, and his mother, and feeling included and feeling immediately a part of a very traditional home that I never had, you know.
I relate to that so much. I remember I could list you the boyfriends I picked because of their families.
Yeah. I mean, and when we broke up, I wasn't of course, it was a big loss to have a breakup with him. We had been together and we were kids, and but it was really the mom.
Yeah.
And that was really devastating for me.
Did you stay friends?
He, you mean with a guy?
Both.
He remember eventually remarried. It was very sort of old school, kind of romantic, sad, you know. He was like, I'll wait for you when you get this acting thing, because I left Tucson and I wanted to go, you know, do theater and be an actress. He's like, why don't you, I'll give it a couple years in Chicago, and why don't you see how you feel when you're, you know. And I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, maybe I'll get it out of my system and that will be the end of that. And you know, that was sort of the sad, beautiful thing. I know. And so eventually he got married, and he didn't feel it was appropriate to keep in contact, which of course I was like, why? And then I was like, oh, okay, I got it. And the mom I eventually saw years and years later, but no, in the time when it was really critical, she of course chose her son, you know. And it was so this odd thing that I don't even know if anybody, your number one talks about that, like those odd moments of like, oh, I will lose this entire support
group,
system and family. Which was
and
devastating to me.
And you're so right. And I think it's such a huge part, particularly of those teenage years, of needing something to push against. Like, you can't rebel unless you've got a family that can contain
that. Was
rebellion.
Exactly what happened. I had this Mary Poppins, like, I mean, the most loving incredibly maternal. Like, I would never felt so loved and embraced, and then had to leave it. I grew up. Mm. I was like, I gotta go now. Mm. And I remember that moment too of her seeming just infallible and completely perfect, and then seeing her as an adult and mm-hmm. her fallibility and things that I disagreed with her. And I was like, and yeah, but it's so hard. Mm. That, because I had this completely different childhood experience where I felt like the adult most of my childhood. And then to be able to have this beautiful experience from 15 to 19, feeling like a child and feeling taken care of and loved and nurtured, and was really, really incredible. And yeah. then by that weird thing that you just said of like, oh, I have to leave now. I have yeah. to grow up and be in the big, bad world. I can't just stay in this protected nest. Mm. Yeah. So
had you been to England by this point when you read Howard's End?
No.
Mm-mm. And that, isn't it funny? And again, I relate to this too, that because it's so specific, the world Forster writes about, and it's so,
yes,
it's so of its time, you know, pre-war and Edwardian and these country houses and these social codes and the hierarchies, they're so strict. And you know, part of me was, when I was looking at your books, and I was thinking, I wonder what in Kate resonated with this book. Like, I wonder what part, you know, I didn't know it was going to be that college and all of that. And I was thinking, I wonder if she'd been to England yet, because presumably it was going to fall somewhere in the early chapters of your yeah. life. And then I was thinking, and yet it doesn't matter. I mean, there are Japanese kids who've never set foot in England for whom Jane Austen is
yeah.
God, you know.
Well, and the landscape and these cultures, or whether it's Dickens or whether it's yeah. Forster or whether it's Bronte, or it's so specifically drawn out, and so it's so richly the tapestry and details mm. of it, that you feel, I felt like I was there. Mm. And the fantasy that is just like solidified, or mm. I just felt like, oh, it's like the longing for something that I'll never be able to experience, right. even if, you know.
Right.
But I... And years later, I mean, I did in my, I guess, mid-20s, I went to England, but I didn't have this experience. No. I didn't go to anybody's country house. I didn't, you know, it was completely different.
You didn't mistakenly inherit an enormous country
house. I did not.
Power.
And the Oxford Too School bad. Of Drama was a totally different experience than, Howard's End. But I did, it did start that course in, that the University of Arizona with Roger Bowen, who was British, and modern British literature, started this real love affair for me of British writers and this clean, very male.
Mm.
I really
who
felt.
Who else did you love?
I mean, for? I loved the guy who did the magazine, The Collector, Fowles, John
yeah,
Fowles.
John Fowles, yeah. I didn't know you loved him.
Oh my God. That oh, was all. Really? I was like, well, do I do The Collector? Because that was a great one for me.
It's funny. That's one my mum put me onto.
Martin Amis.
Yeah.
I mean,
but you sound like you were well on the way to being a reader anyway.
If you had Cannery Row at nine. Yeah, and so I had, but I had read up until then mostly, I think, American mm-hmm. authors, mm-hmm. you know, but men, mm. you know.
Interesting.
Except for Flannery O'Connor, I started reading her short stories and plays, and that was really great. But I did kind of develop this very sexist attitude.
What changed it? Has anything changed it?
Amy Bloom.
Really? Mm-hmm. She's not the next one on your list, but do you want to jump to her since she's
Well, what?
There?
Yeah, sure. Who was the next one
you
on my list?
You had Barrel Fever and Other
oh
Stories,
my God.
David Sedaris, 1994.
That was really... Yeah, we could... I don't know which one
where you
want to
talk. Wherever you want
Barrel
to go,
Fever.
Then.
Let me talk about David Sedaris, because that was a super romantic time in my life where I had just moved from Chicago to New York. Uh-huh. I just started making a living erratically, sporadically as an actor, waitress, actor, and struggling in New York, but in the most romantic way. There was a mass sort of Chicago exodus at that time where all of us came over. It was Adam McKay, Amy Poehler, Tina Fey. You know, they were doing Upright Citizens Brigade. So there was this huge community of all of us that were still like waiting tables, but doing our crazy late night
so
improv shows. And like, we were like papering for UCB and helping. And
it was doing my sketch comedy then too?
Yeah. And improv, long form improv. There was this group called Burn Manhattan that Shira Piven directed that I did. It was like five guys and me doing improv. And it was like, when I was in Chicago, it was a huge, obviously it's still a great mm-hmm. improv scene, but there was a really, it was a special time, like, you know, geez, Dave Koechner, Lauren Katz, so many great improvisers. Mm-hmm. And it was this long form style that was developed by Del Close, and that sort of just one suggestion or not. And it was just beautiful. It was like watching jazz, really. Yeah. In fact, there was a team called Jazz Freddy that was incredible. Mm-hmm. Like these just genius people. And much better than I ever was, but they were just incredible. So it was a really magical time in New York. And it was like when Conan just started, mm-hmm. and Andy Richter and Sarah Thayer and all of us. So it was this very rich community, and it was the first time I lived in a city that was purely like a city, like a proper, like, mm-hmm. Chicago is I think like the quintessential American city, but you don't have to have a car in New York you can get by just on the subway. Yeah. So it was the first time I had the experience of riding a subway all the time, and I didn't have any money for cabs, so I was and having a book in the subway, which is such a special experience.
So great, isn't it? I know, I smile just thinking about it.
Yeah. And so to have a book, and then to have a book, and also David Sedaris lived in New York, in Brooklyn, and he was just coming about then. And
it's so to first collection of short stories,
So to read Barrel Fever, it was the first time I read a book that made me laugh out loud. And so that was just sort of this, when I was thinking about books that changed my life, the idea of just being on a subway amidst a train full of, you know, strangers laughing, hit like uncontrollably, like wet my pants laughing at these at these stories. And I had never heard him, you know, later I heard him read his work, but I had never heard him read aloud, which was also great. But again, great writing or things that touch you personally, you have your own, you don't even need to hear, I didn't need to hear his tonal inflection to make me laugh. It was how he wrote, it just... And the ridiculousness, and again, identifying because of the ridiculous shit jobs that you take to, and the experiences to, as you're trying to find a way to subsidize your art and get by. So that was just really magical.
It's so fun. I agree. I was so glad when I saw his name on your list. I was like, yeah, no one's had a Sedaris yet. This is so true. He's huge. And particularly for someone like you, who is so, so funny and whose humor is so... just defiantly self-deprecating in spite of how enormously beautiful and accomplished you are. But it's true, Lovie. And I was thinking like, oh yes, of course, that makes complete sense that he would be on your list because you know, the main story of the Barrel Fever, I pulled it down off the shelf to have a look at it and remind myself about it. And, you know, half of them are short stories, fictional, and then the other half is autobiographical.
Right.
So it's both. But the best stuff, to my mind anyway, is the autobiographical stuff. And the main one is Santaland.
Santaland.
Being the elf.
Oh, my God.
In Santaland. And I was just
Santaland,
like...
Diaries. It's...
Talk about turning straw, spinning straw into gold, man. That's...
I know.
It. And in the midst of that comedy period in your life, it makes such sense that this would resonate.
And just that weird, think about it, like that, when the first book that made you laugh out loud, you know, that was just a really, it was such a delight. I just remember I couldn't wait to get back on the train and read that book. It was like my train book, you know.
I still love him. Do you still read him? Do you still go to UCLA? Like whenever he comes to UCLA.
I heard him. I think the first time I actually heard him was at UCLA years and years ago when I first moved here.
Yeah. His you're right, his voice is so distinctive, and once you've heard it you can't unhear it.
I know,
you can't read a Sedaris thing in a New Yorker and not hear him saying it anymore.
I know.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's bachelorette bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Well, now let's go to your next book, which is Amy Bloom. Amy Bloom's book, Away, which was published in 2007. And this is another one that I know I have on a bookcase and I've never read it. So tell me a little bit about, tell me what you remember about it, or without feeling like you have no pressure.
No, with her, I'm admitting it. I had been sort of other than like the Bronte sisters or something, I think because going back to when I first started reading And a good deal of even childhood books were male protagonists. They were heroes having these fantastic experiences. And that's what I identified with, was the adventure that boys were having. And they were written mostly by men. And so I didn't have, maybe it's because my stepdad wasn't mostly the one who was giving me the books. It wasn't my mom. Mm-hmm. I didn't have Heloise. I didn't have these sort of quintessential children's stories that were girls. Mm-hmm. So I really identify with a hero. Mm.
Did the girls seem wimpy? Did they seem, or just unrelatable?
Well, just in some ways, like I loved, you know, like Wuthering Heights, the longing for
Heathcliff. I'm surprised Wuthering Heights didn't make the cut.
It was on there, but I took it off. Because that longing and the unrequited love, I mean, that was like, oh my, I mean, that was my, you know, narrative, I think, until probably just a year ago. No. But longing, so amazing. It's the best drug in the world is longing. But I did sort of have this sort of sexist attitude, and I felt like a lot of female authors that I had heard about or heard other friends, until I met you, really, honestly, it was a lot of sort of chick lit, if you will, you know, beach reads.
Right.
But the modern British literature, Russian literature, there are these, and the classics for me, I just felt like that richness is what my imagination really needed to pull me into a world and keep me there. And then I was there, you know, it's like 50 pages into a book, 100, and then you're like, I don't want to be anywhere. I just want to get back to my book.
Yeah.
But with Amy Bloom, I forget who told me about her. The first book that I read was called Come to Me, and I can't remember if those were short stories, but I would describe it now in retrospect as the first time I was reading someone who was writing from the female gaze, if you will.
Sure.
And she was so smart and so emotional and intelligent. There was something, I don't know how to describe it, that I was just blown away by. I wanted to read everything she wrote. Mm-hmm. And then I did, and I got Away, which is this epic adventure. And this amazing female protagonist and all of these characters. And still to me, whether it's scripts or books or character and story, or that's it. It's character and story, character and story. And this thing was so dense and beautiful and heartbreaking. And all of the characters were so incredible that this Away was the first time I actually wanted this. Now I read it probably 10 years ago, maybe, that I was like, I want to make this into something.
Right.
And I thought it was the perfect piece. It was just when the television miniseries or, you know, limited series started happening. Mm-hmm. But it was a little too early. But I remember I got to go meet her in New York. Mm-hmm. And she was teaching, I forget what university, which she teaches at. She lives upstate and teaches. And she's this fascinating woman. Mm. And, you know, we shopped it around for a bit, and I didn't get it made in the end. But I did. Mm. And then I didn't have enough power. Mm-hmm. It's just trying to produce it, you know, and get it to get it made. But she was incredible. But I still love it. And I still think it would be like an incredible. So if anybody wants to go get that, go talk to Amy.
Hook me up.
And make it happen. But it's not even, there's not even a role for me in it. It's just an incredible story. It's historical. It's, you know.
Do you remember what it's about? Or in
set around the pogroms. It's about this woman who loses in a day her entire village and family in, I don't know if it's the Cossacks, but the pogroms come in and just, destroy her village. She's Jewish. She gets on a boat, comes to New York City, starts working, in a button factory or something. And then from there, it's just this adventure. It's, part Jewish immigrant, part she ends up prostituting herself. She finds out that her child might be alive, that may have gotten out of the village and rescued and went across. It becomes like this mythic, epic journey and of her crossing the country, crossing America, and then ending up in. And she starts out as this sort of orphan in the world, and immediately people are starting to try to take advantage of her, and then just all the characters that she meets across on her journey and her own journey of strength and discovery and. She's like a female Jeremiah Johnson. She becomes like this. It's an incredible role for a young actress. And all these great characters that she encounters all along the way. And there's just amazing female stories and history in it. Because it's all turn of the 20th century, 19th to 20th America. And it's incredible.
Sounds wonderful. I mean, like I said, when I read about it, I was like, nope, this is another one I haven't read. And I mean, reading about it and what you've just talked about, this odyssey that she's on, this journey from just geographically New York to Alaska, I think she ends up thinking...
And her lover and their men and relationships and the mother and trying to find... So much happens. But it also, just the point of it being a heroine, but she's having a hero's journey.
Like a hero's
and
journey.
And I think that that's what Amy Bloom, and she writes about all these, that she wrote the book of essays just on transgender, transsexual, all these that were nonfiction, just a study, and because she's also was a psychiatrist and psychologist, I think. And just she's just a fascinating person.
That sounds fascinating. I'd love to read that collection.
Yeah.
Sounds really cool.
Yeah. And I'd love to go back and read that too.
But. Really struck by what you're saying about I just did my podcast and my interview, and not one of my five authors were women. And I hadn't thought of that until you commented on that. And I think of myself as someone who is so ungendered when it comes to recommending or thinking about books or, you know, sorting through. And I wonder, I had a moment while you were talking of being sort of momentarily distracted and thinking, oh my God, there was no women in my list. And is that something I don't even know that operates on me?
Right.
And then I think, no, I mean... Elizabeth Strout is someone I feel about in the way that, you know, you were talking about Amy Bloom. And I think, I think of Elizabeth Strout in that way. And, you know, I first discovered her with Olive Kitteridge, and which is, I think, one of the few things that translated to film really beautifully, actually.
Yeah, HBO, yeah. I haven't read that. I read the Anything is Possible.
Yes.
Because I do everything you tell me to do. I'm like, what are you reading?
It's a really, really good thing to be. Just obey me, Kate. You'll be fine. Is. Stick with me. But yeah, no, Olive Kitteridge is wonderful. And like I say, one of the few really successful adaptations where you get this amazing collection of short stories and then this beautiful HBO, Frances McDormand.
Yeah, it was incredible.
Nails it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I read everything by her. I mean, as soon as I discovered her, I was like, Elizabeth Strout, where have you been my whole life? But then I realized that you're right. They're not. There are many men that I have done that with. Richard Yates. Richard
Revolutionary
Ford.
Road. Yeah. I know. Just looking at. He was on my shelf. Men and Women. Was it Men and Women?
Women and Men.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just looking at that. I'm like, oh my God.
There are, you know, Henry James. There are a bunch for me for whom I've just needed to devour everything they've written. John Fante is another, weirdly, but. But not as many women that I've compulsively felt like I need to read, I need to know you, I need to know you inside and out.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
gonna ponder
what's
that
his
one.
Name? You know, Ian McEwan.
Ian McEwan. Yes.
Yeah, that's another. I mean, Atonement was up there too.
Yes.
That was a big
was that one that nearly
was. I was like,
yeah.
And then I'm like, wait, I just Labine is incredible. It's hard just because great novels, great books are just they're just, all of them profoundly affect you, and you know, but. But Amy Bloom was the first, other than maybe the Bronte sister, like I said, but that I really was like, oh, she's writing from this place that I have never experienced a woman writing from in contemporary, but writing about, historical fiction.
Right.
But, yeah.
And then your last book is A Visit from the Goon Squad, which I
Jennifer
also
Egan.
Loved. Jennifer Egan, 2011. Tell me why this one made the cut. What was it? What about this?
Well, I know. I was torn between this, oddly, and Turgenev, Torrents of Spring.
Oh, there you go.
Because they're so similar. No, because...
Lucky Jennifer Egan.
Well, Jennifer Egan, again, another female author for me that... has this deft ability to write sort of about pop culture and about current stuff. And for me, I usually shy away from that. And I think that's why Beach Reads or whatever, I'm like not interested in because I want to escape into a really deep, rich world or of character. Or she has, I feel like, this ability to write contemporary and even future, like A Visit from the Goon Squad, and from so many different perspectives, but also have this really wicked wit and irony.
Yeah.
And but... deep, deep sense and humor, but huge pathos and just gutting sadness that just really gets me in all of her books. So, but that one, I remember reading that and then going, I think I had read her others, Emerald City and then the one about the model, but...
I don't know that one. I only know The Keep and this one.
I read all... There's Emerald City and there's another one about this model that... Look at Me, I think it is, but... everything she writes, I want to read, and I've been dying. And then, of course, Paul Edelstein's sister knows her really well.
Oh, really?
He's like, I could introduce you. I'm like, well, you have to make that happen. I really want to meet
her.
How
have we been friends this long?
I know. How is that? But I was anxiously and just found out when I was looking it up, because, of course, I said, welcome to the Goon Squad, but it's a visit from the Goon Squad, that her new novel's coming out, which I'm really excited to read.
When did you... This came out in 2011. Do you remember where you were when you were reading?
That's the thing. I was here in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I didn't want to put it down. I don't really have anything more interesting to say about it. Except I also love that it was the way she told the book, for the story. From there were just so many different... taking turns and sort of all these different points of view and, and people. And I loved her... This sort of character study of these, say, this little group of characters, but also this future tripping that she kind of does with the wall in New York and the hand, the starfish and the windmills and the, you know, climate change and all of this stuff that I felt was so awesome and imminent and, you know, specific.
Yeah. It's fun that, isn't it? It's fun when, it's such a gift, I think, to be able to write about the future as an author. And to still to ride that wave of keeping it real and grounded, and characters still behaving in a recognizable way, but just with this shift in the background, where the future is just the format against which you're not distracted by it. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Where you're still focused on the human interaction rather than dazzled by
it's emotionally,
the Blade Runner.
It's emotionally driven and psychologically driven. Yeah. And you've been with these people. So it's sort of like that, not to, you know, make a really maybe not fair compare, but that last episode of 6 Feet Under where they future trip and there's that, and you're just like gutted. And for me, it's the same way. And why it was odd that I was thinking about Torrance of Spring, because there is a thing with time, and Ian McEwan does it too, and that loss, that irretrievable loss of like you can never, what has been done and you can never go back. And he nails it, of course, in Atonement, but you're just like the one thing that changed the course of everything forever and cannot be undone. And
do you believe in that?
I don't know if I believe in it, but I'm definitely deeply... I think, okay, when I was looking at it, because I was, you know, I told you last night, it might be Torrance of Spring. Because Torrance of Spring, I haven't read Remembrance of Things Past. I hope to one day. But the Torrance of Spring...
You let me know how that works.
Yeah, exactly. Whatever. When
read,
I really,
read it for me.
I guess I have to break another shoulder to do that.
Oh,
no,
God,
I'm kidding. Don't even say it. But
awesome.
I feel like to have one of my biggest fears... hasn't been about dying or if aging. It's more like, what if I'm haunted by memories, or what if I'm haunted by loss, or the loneliness of memories, and that's all I don't know. I don't know how to. It's not
but haunted by memories of things you've done or things you've left undone. Or both.
I think maybe both, or like one false move or one thing, or I'm really intrigued by that, you know. And in Torrance of Spring, it's there's, you know, he finds a garnet cross, and then he's an old man and he looks back.
I don't know the book.
Oh my God, it's great. It's a really beautiful, simple read, but it's so, it was that thing that just affected me of like, he made one, just this idea, this mythic, like he chose this road. And it was love. It's like the basic lesson of love versus lust, which is something my father, before he died, was like, love is the most important thing, not lust. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I love the differentiation. Let's be clear. But anyway, I'm sort of digressed. But with Jennifer Egan, I felt like that thing of going, taking these characters that you've been with now, and their nascent sort of stages and their very even contemporary struggles, but then going forward in this future, this imaginative world, and feeling so like attached to them and kind of gutted by all the loss and everything that has ensued and that they've endured was like a really... Yeah.
Yeah, I loved that book too. I really did. I thought it was beautifully written. It's funny, it's just talking about the future stuff, I just finished this book on vacation called The Power, which is wonderful. It is light, but I really recommend it. She's called Naomi Alderman. It's an English book. I think it comes out here this month. It's already
out
in the UK. And the premise is so ingenious and wonderful. It's set way deep into the future, and women have been running the world for thousands of years. Thousands and thousands of years. Other than that, the world is exactly the same. The geography of it, everything. It's just that they are trying to reconstruct from fragments of leftover civilizations what patriarchal society must have looked like. And they're trying to figure, and they sort of can't believe, like, there's a little series of letters between these two people who are giggling at the idea and then trying to remain serious about it. But back in the day when armies were made up of men, and how hilarious that must have been. And then,
oh, interesting.
It's wonderful. And the whole book is framed by these two letters. It's a man who's writing what he thinks is a historical novel or a piece of historical fiction about the past when men were in charge, or about the moment when women took over power.
Right.
So he's writing a letter to his editor saying, here's the manuscript. Forgive me, it's really imperfect, and there's loads of leaps of faith, and I really hope you'll bear with me. And what's so wonderful is just the letters alone, the framing device, because the manuscript is obviously the novel itself. And then there's a letter at the end where the editor replies back to the author. And the editor is a woman. And the way the man writes to his editor is the way women write these days. It's so brilliant and so subtle, but his letter to his editor is full of open-ended statements and exclamation marks and hope you like it, hope I didn't go too far. And I winced reading it. I mean, I pray I don't write emails like that, but I recognize that at some point I have and still do on occasion. But there was something supplicatory and open-ended and slightly wistful about the whole tone.
And this is the male,
and that's the male author writing to his editor, and the female editor is writing with these really declarative, short, brisk sentences saying, great, I'll get to it when I can, look forward to reading it. And just the topsy-turvyism of it is wonderful.
That's hysterical.
And that's just
really
the framing
great.
Device. Yeah. That's cool. And then the book itself is great. It's a quick read and it's really fun, and I really recommend it. So,
oh, good.
The power. Now, I have a quick list of, these are just quick questions. You zoom through them, you answer what you can and what you feel like. What was the last book that made you cry?
Oh, All the Light We Cannot See.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Sobbed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful one.
Mm-hmm. Because I just read that in the spring.
Did
when
you?
I was, yeah, in New York. Yeah.
It's a beautiful book. Yeah, I wept in that too.
Yeah.
What's the book you're most ashamed of loving? Is there one?
Oh, my God. Oh, my gosh. I can't think of one. What's yours? Do you have one?
I was trying to think of mine too. I did not love 50 Shades of Grey, but I did read it.
Oh, you did?
I read them
good
all.
Good for you.
I read them all because I read everything.
You know,
and I always like I should know. I read all of the Game of Thrones books. I don't remember a single word of any of them, but
yeah,
I felt like I have to read these. I have to know what is happening in the world.
I know. You have the voracious appetite.
No, but it's also coupled with a completely colander for a memory, so I hold on to like a sentence.
That's how I am. That's okay. I'm glad to hear that because I'm like, wait a minute.
I had to go to the internet and make sure I hadn't read how
it ended. But I did love Summons to Memphis. Everything that you,
that was a good one.
Yeah. Were you the one that said just go whatever's nominated for the, you know, if it's a Pulitzer nominated? Someone would have told me like, here's a good thing to do.
Check out the nominees.
Yeah. If it's nominated, a winner, or on the short list, like you know, it's gonna be like there's something's gonna be.
That's a good tip.
Okay. So what else?
Is there a book or author you feel most guilty about not having read?
Yes. I have it. It's on my... I have the new translation of Anna Karenina.
Oh, so fun. I just finished it.
Did the one?
Wonderful. No.
With the man and the woman translating?
Well, the man and the woman did it a while ago, so it's not a new translation.
Oh, it isn't?
One. No.
Oh, I thought... But then they went... I thought... Because, you know, Maria Dizia told me about that. Right?
Yeah.
She was like, this is the one to read.
I have to wait till
winter. And it's not a summer book. It's not a beat. I can read it here.
I read it in Tuscany and it worked.
You did?
Fine.
And it was fine?
It
I know. Somebody gave me a lot of shit for it I was trying to read it in Lisbon. They're like, you know what? Not Anna Karenina.
You're Anna Karenina.
Yeah.
It's amazing. You're in for such a treat. Kindle, print, audiobook. Do you have a preference?
Print.
Always?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Fiction versus non. Do you read nonfiction?
Fiction for sure.
Always?
Yeah, pretty much. Like, I mean, this woman who won with the wolves is like interesting, but it's like a side piece. So it's like right now I have like poetry. Like David White, I'm reading and then a nonfiction piece, and just to sort of peruse through, and then there's got to be a fiction.
Yeah.
But that's what I really respond to always.
I think you just answered this. Who do you take your book recommendations from?
Sonia Walger.
Pulitzer Prize winners.
Exclusively. But no, and then, my brother before you was always my brother. Yes.
Joe or Sean.
Yeah, Joe.
Yeah.
But then Sean too, but my brother Sean is more of a nonfiction reader. He's reading like Studs Terkel work. He's just like in there. My dad was a voracious reader. My mother is a big reader. I mean, we all love to read, but it's just, Joe was always more the classics.
Right.
And so he's read everything. He has read Proust. I'm like, good for you. So
at least someone in the family.
That's
perfect.
Has. Yeah.
No one in my family has.
Yeah.
Again, you've just talked about this, but poetry, yes, no, indifferent.
Yes. Yeah. That's been recent, you know, I'll talk, you're going to have to edit this down, but you can put it in.
No, I put everything
in. So when I had, you know, a couple years ago, a brain tumor, and part of my symptoms were, I was trying to read, as I told you before, Murakami, The Wind-Up Bird Chronicles, which is dense anyway. That was Joe Walsh, was like, you gotta read this. And I was like, boy, this is really dense. And I'm not able to really kind of do more than a couple sentences.
The tumor that's in my brain.
Yeah, actually it's a tumor in my brain. But when I was recovering from brain surgery, this is a whole other podcast, but poetry was really helpful.
Really?
Because it was, and even before, and I just thought it was my short attention span due to our modern culture and devices, I could take it in. Mm-hmm. I could take in just short sentences or a poem easier and process it easier than I couldn't retain. I couldn't focus or concentrate that long.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Because poetry is just metaphor, right?
Yeah.
And how interesting that your brain could unpack that.
Mm-hmm.
That was more digestible than pages of literal narrative.
Yeah. It was too exhausting for me in the beginning. And then I loved it just as a tool to have all the time. Part of it was Kim Gillingham, we both work with, but just as a practice before I go to bed to read a line of poetry so that I have that image in my head. Yeah.
That's lovely.
So I have David White, I have Salt, I have... Oh my God, I have like...
Salt, which is Nahira Waheed.
Nahira Waheed. Oh my Amazing. God, that was the biggest gift ever, which I've regifted so many times to many people.
Mary Oliver.
Mary Oliver, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So those sort of three. And then Pablo Neruda just made it in. Yeah.
Steal that.
Well, also because to stop from not having the phone be the last thing. Sure. So, and sometimes when it's the end of the day, if I'm not really entrenched in a novel, it's easier for me to read a line of poetry or just some poems. And then that's it. Yeah.
Add Voyage of the Sable Venus, Robin Cross Lewis. That's going to be a great one to have by the bed.
I got to write that down. Yeah.
Is there a book you wish you'd written? Is there, meaning, I mean, you can say Anna Karenina, but I mean, do you have literary aspirations? I know you write. I know you've
written. You know, there's always a part of it. It's funny when we were talking about, I was just thinking about that. There's such a, you know, so many women are writing memoirs or writing their stories or essays. And I've always thought I would love to do that because I have so many stories and I've had such a...
A huge life. Yeah.
But I think the thing that thus far holds me back is there's that age old thing, I guess, of not, I love amazing writing and I wouldn't be an amazing writer. I can tell a good story and I really love the oral tradition. But so I don't know if it's just heretofore lack of discipline of sitting down, but also I don't know if I feel like I want to get in that. It's like a sacred area for me.
I so understand.
Right? So you're like...
If you're not going to be excellent at it, why do it?
Yeah. And that sounds so basic. And like an artist or a mentor would say that, no, you must persevere. Yeah. But you're like, really? Must I?
Must I?
Really? Must? And I feel like so many, and I get very jaded sometimes about all the people that are writing their little, everybody's like, you're writing a book, aren't you? And I'm like, really? It feels like... I have this kind of critical mind about it right now of like the culture, the pop culture. Everybody's got, you know, oh, I'm writing, you're naturally writing a book. And it's sort of annoying to me.
Yeah.
You know?
I do know. I do. I also.
It's that age of the internet, you know?
Yeah.
You're like, everybody's writing a book. You're like, maybe you shouldn't. Maybe you should read other people's books. Like, right. I know, that sounds like cunty, but.
I still think you have a really, really good collection of essays in you, but I'll let it slide.
Okay, thank you.
What do you wish you read more of, if anything?
I mean, Dostoevsky. Like, I haven't read any Henry James. Yeah, so those are on the list. Like, just
Yeah.
Is there a book you liked that you thought you'd hate?
That's a great question. No.
No. And do you read when you work? And how does work reading affect your work?
Yeah. I got into a place here in LA. It's so easy to do. And then I just made a conscious decision to just always have a book going. Mm. Because it's very easy when you're, and when you have kids and you're, you know, when you're working and shooting, it's very easy to just not have mm-hmm. a book. Mm-hmm. And, but I think it's important to always have one. I don't know why. So, because for years I was like, when you're in the height of it, you're like, no, you get pulled into this business and there's so much going on. I'm exhausted. So, but you start, otherwise you just start being a person that just reads articles.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's just soul killing.
Yeah, I agree. No, it's interesting. I find that the writers that I've spoken to struggle to read when they work. The actors can't do without it. But...
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. But I would imagine because don't you find as a, because you write as well, when I read a book and if I'm writing at the time, I will start taking on the
style. Oh, I'll start writing
the
that
style.
Book.
Yeah.
Oh, that or, book, yeah, that terrible pastiche.
Yeah, exactly.
But
or I'll start taking on the style because you're reading it and we're actors and we're sponges. Totally. So you're just like, I'm starting to write in the style of Amy
David
Bloom.
Sedaris.
Or David Sedaris.
While writing
or,
a tragedy. So
yeah.
This is fucked up.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, so this is a question that I love asking. What is the book that makes you... You know you look good when you recommend it. This is your surefire, this will get you laid if you're reading it at a bar book.
Revolutionary Road.
Oh, nice.
Who can argue with that?
So glad.
It's so it is a perfect book.
It is.
It's perfectly
it's
written.
It's one of my five, you know that, right?
Yeah, okay, yeah, yeah. I mean, but it is a perfect book.
Yeah.
And it's male, and it's the 50s. It's so gonna get you laid.
So
you're like,
you
what's
late.
Up?
I know.
Boom, enjoy me. Yeah, yeah.
So good. Okay, last question. You get to take one book to your desert island. What is it?
Oh, that's great. Oh, see, maybe... Oh, do you want it to be a long one? I mean, maybe Atonement.
Oh, lovely.
But you'd want it to go on and on forever. And there's also, I didn't put this one in, The Book Thief, which I love, which is considered young adult fiction.
Oh, yeah, it's
did
lovely,
you,
that one. Yeah, the Spanish also, blanking on his name.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I did read The Book Thief. It was lovely.
I don't know why I loved that. I was really moved by that one. But, yeah, but I would take probably Atonement.
Great. Kate Walsh, you're a dream guest. Thank you so much for doing my
podcast.
You're
so nice. Thank you. Thank
lovely.
You.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's interview. If you like the show, please write us a review on iTunes, on the website. It really makes a difference. Rate us, give us some stars, let your friends know, let your family know, tell everyone you can. Go to the website, bookishwithsonyawalger.com, if you want to find out about any of the books that you heard about. We list there not only the five favorites, but every single book that is referenced. You can also buy the books through the website, and we make a tiny, tiny little percentage of whatever you buy through the website. So if you are interested, please go ahead and click on that. You can find us on Facebook. We have a Bookish with Sonia Walger page. You can find us on Twitter with @BookishSonia or @SoniaWalger.com. And you could also email me through the info@BookishWithSoniaWalger.com page. If you hit on contact, it'll just automatically pop up as an email there. So if you have any ideas for guests that you'd like to hear from or thoughts that you have about the show, please don't hesitate to share them there. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the show.